I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. Today, we're revisiting the Ukraine. There have been developments since we talked last time. Fast-moving environment over there. The biggest thing, Jim, was the occupation of the Crimea by the Russians. What happened there, and what is that effect going to have going forward?
This was the same playbook the Russians used, or the Soviets used, in late 1940s in Eastern Europe. They basically sent in a lot of their own operatives. Now, in this case, they can send in Russians, ethnic Russians from Russia. You know, the border is pretty porous, you know, with Ukraine. And they can send them in, which they've been doing, and basically pose as Ukrainians. Now, Ukrainians see right through this, but the Russian state-controlled media is there to photograph it, to interview selected people, and get out to the world the image that these are Ukrainians, or at least, you know, Russian Ukrainians, asking to be liberated from Ukraine. And, of course, again, because of the Internet, it doesn't work as well as it did in the late 40s. It is getting out, you know, what's going on. And this is what it is. It's the same routine, you know, 60 years later. The Ukrainians are appalled because they see the Internet. They see that a lot of the reporting is that this is what it isn't. In other words, that these are, you know, Ukrainian Russians, you know, asking to be part of Russia, when the majority of them, indeed, the only Russian to be killed in Crimea, which the Russians complained about, was a Ukrainian Russian who was protesting the Russian invasion. He was killed by a sniper. Russians never mentioned that aspect of it. But this is how absurd it is getting, and the Russians simply believe that they'll get away with it. The other thing that doesn't come out too much is that the Russians are not playing a military game. In other words, the military matter is insignificant to the Russians, because the Russians, they do very good staff work. They do what I learned years ago was what they call a correlation of forces, where they literally and very dispassionately, even in the old days, well, look at what we got, what they got, and what would happen if we went to war. And they look at that and they say, you know, we're toast, because, you know, we have no force to invade with, you know, none that it would do anything. And they know that because in 2008, they invaded Georgia with 26,000 troops. All they could scrape together, and nearly half of them were local militiamen, you know, who just didn't like Georgians, and were willing to come along for looting privileges. And that was something of a disaster. I mean, let me put it this way. For those who forget, there was a lot of embarrassing incidents for the Russians during that invasion. So the Russians know that they haven't fixed all the problems that they identified after 2008. And so they really can't expect to invade. Plus, the Russians know more than the West that the Ukraine has been very rebellious for centuries. There was a guerrilla war by Ukrainian Democrats after World War II. Actually, it started before the war ended. That lasted into the 1950s. The CIA tried to support this effort, this uprising. But again, the police state was too effective in Russia. The one thing the Russians did do that was effective was they created a much more efficient police state. Unfortunately, for them, they couldn't find a way to make a state-controlled economy work. But the Russians know that they can't invade Ukraine because the Ukrainians would fight, even if their army isn't, you know, the best army in the world. The Ukrainians, in general, would oppose the Russians. Including, and the Russians don't want this to be publicized too much, the ethnic Russian minority in Ukraine, the majority of them will come out and tell you, and this is what reporters who get in there, you know, keep encountering, that we are Ukrainian first. Yes, we prefer to speak Russian, and we consider, well, we know we're ethnic Russians, but we would rather live in a free Ukraine than in Russia. which speaks volumes about what is really going on over there. So what Putin and his cronies are doing is they're using the economic weapons they have, and their economic weapons are far more potent because they supply almost all of the natural gas that Ukraine has become very dependent upon. There are a lot of trade links with Ukraine. And, of course, the Ukraine's problem was that after 1991, when they split from Russia, Ukraine, more than most other parts of Russia, had much of its economy linked to factories and businesses inside of Russia and other parts of the Soviet Union. And the economic collapse was worse in the Ukraine than it was in other parts of Russia. And since the Ukraine had been part of Russia for centuries, they, unlike Poland and other Eastern European countries, had no periods, even a few decades, where they were free and they had people who remembered, yeah, this is how you do it. So they basically have been wallowing in corruption and governmental mismanagement, you know, for the last 20 years. They finally got to the point where they had got enough Ukrainians to agree, including a lot of corrupt politicians, that let's make a deal with Western Europe where they will be able to freely, you know, invest, and we'll pass laws to make it at least more difficult, you know, to shake them down and be corrupt as we have so often been. But at the last minute, the Russians came in and bribed the recently deposed Ukrainian president, who, by the way, got elected on his promise to set up a deal with the Western Europe like this, which is why the Ukrainians were so angry about his, you know, basically everybody understood he took a big bribe from the Russians. And now that they've gotten into his assets since he's fled to Russia, they now realize he stole more than they even imagined from the Ukraine. So the Ukrainians are basically desperate. They've spent 20 years spinning their wheels, going backwards. Their GDP, their per capita income has actually declined since 1991. They understand what the solution is, and the solution is breaking free from Russia. But Russia doesn't want that to happen. And the Russians are willing to cut off the natural gas, not just to Ukraine, but also to Western Europe. And basically, the Russians are willing to take a hit, you know, with the economic connections, the trade connections with Western Europe, which people should understand are in trouble even without the Ukraine situation, because the corruption inside of Russia has been deadly as far as foreign investors go. The horror stories are endless. And the pressure's been constantly on Putin and the other people running Russia. You've got to clean this up because we're not going to invest in Russia anymore. In fact, a lot of Russian money, a lot of it stolen, has been leaving the country. And the Russians are beside themselves on how to stop that. They're basically losing all local capital, not getting any foreign capital, and their economy is going nowhere except for the natural resources, selling the oil and the gas. But, and this is the big difference, the Russians, at least the Russian leadership, is willing to put all this at risk more than Europe is willing to take the risk. Now, Europe takes a hit, too, if the gas gets cut off and trade links get cut off. But the Europeans are better prepared to rebuild. The trouble is, the Europeans are more unwilling to risk that than the Russians are. And the Russians know this, or at least they believe this, and this is why they believe they're going to basically absorb Ukraine. You know, not immediately, but they're going to basically cut off any hope for Western economic links in the Ukraine, which would rebuild Ukraine. They're basically going to enslave Ukraine. And this is the belief within Russia. This is what you talk to Russians. This is what they'll, I mean, I'm talking about people in Russian businessmen and, you know, economists and bankers and what have you, people I have access to. This is what they will tell you. Not all of them are in favor of it because these guys are going to take a loss in all the chaos that follows. But this is how Russian politicians now think. And a lot of Russians support that. They admire the strong leader, even if the strong leader is doing a lot of damage to Russia. That's just a national characteristic that a lot of Russians wish would go away, but it's still there and it's still operational.
Austin, your take on
I got some observations. One thing, Jim, talking about Ukraine's economy being closely tied to Russia, that was especially true of the Donetsk region, which is right on the Russian border, heavily industrialized. Realize, Dan, that Ukraine also is an agricultural breadbasket, and even when the Soviet Union collapsed, state farms, state operations, yeah, they were archaic. They weren't prepared to compete, quote unquote. But there had been a lot of, and Jim, I forget the word for it, but it was the underground cabbage growers who were actually making private markets of agricultural products in Ukraine, even as the the Soviet Union was collapsing. There is a term for them. Those sectors did reasonably well. I don't say that they thrived, but that's part of why Ukraine could get along somewhat sluggishly. And from what I'm told, that's more the western two-thirds of Ukraine, where the with the somewhat agricultural success post-Soviet Union. I just point out that the region that was really suffering, Kiev with its industries as well, but also that Donetsk region. Secondly, I want to tinker with Jim's 1947-48 Eastern European analogy. Remember, you have this the Red Army was occupying in toto those areas, so it was easy for the, as Jim says, the infiltration. They really had military control. That's why I think the military element in Crimea, I know Jim's not neglecting it, I think it's more important than, at least the impression I got when in his initial discussion, I think it's extremely important. The Russians in 2014 had base rights, sure, Sevastopol and several other defense installations on the Crimean Peninsula, but you had a Ukrainian military installations as well. And you have the analog in Georgia 2008, every historical analog has got problems, Dan, but I see them as making a military move, and Jim and I have discussed this offline, so is Al Nofi. I see them as making a military move to seize what they consider to be and secure important military assets, Sevastopol. They've also got they got the base rights, but we're going to secure it because of these Ukrainians have it's a different country, and Crimea is Russian, to go back on the traditional demand. I think that military move was extremely important. It was a surprise maneuver. As Jim points out, there have been next to no casualties. The shooting, for the most part, when it's happened, has been warning shots fired by some of these Russian special operations soldiers. By the way, I've also seen a couple of shots that suggested that they weren't weren't special operations troops, but may have been naval security personnel out of Sevastopol. I'm not sure where in Crimea they deployed, but the most of the pictures we have seen are the special operations or special airborne units without identifying unit identification on them. They seized and surrounded important bases, took control. That really was a military move. Now, I think Jim's analysis about the, let's say, dicey economic situation, the very tangled political situation, Russia's not in good shape, but as the key thing that I got out of Jim's statement after tinkering with some of the historical analogs, and I'll interject this here if we want to talk about it. I think Rhineland remilitarization 1936 it's got its problems, but I think it's far more accurate than the Sudetenland comparisons that Hillary Clinton, for example, made, or 2008 Georgia because of the relatively light forces. And what Putin did with this military move was shatter that 1994 Budapest Accord, which guaranteed Ukraine's territorial integrity, that would include Crimea, in exchange for Ukrainian nukes being turned back over to Russia. What Hitler did in 36 was, hey, tore up Versailles, remilitarized the Rhineland, where Hitler escapes a bothersome treaty. Putin escapes a diplomatic accord, which he regarded as a political bind. And here was the whatever went on in Moscow the weekend that Yanukovych or Yanukovych, I hear both the pronunciations, fled Kiev out of the and whether hasty or planned, that Russian move was swift and created a fact on the ground. And Jim's big point is that the Russians have more will to stay than Europeans or Americans have the will to drive them out. I think that's right.
Now, Jim, we got an interesting email last night from somebody that is living in Lithuania that was that it sounds like the Lithuanians and some of the other former Soviet Union states are, the people are getting a little concerned about what has gone on in Ukraine. What is there reason for them to be concerned?
Well, historically, yes. But one of the big differences is the Baltic states, you know, Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia, are now members of NATO. So if Russia does anything aggressive, they can invoke the self-defense clause of the NATO treaty. Now, that's pretty scary. But in the end, it's something that even the Russians will have to, you know, pause and consider. Because the Baltic states are not as isolated. You know, the Germany, you know, there is, NATO has good access to the Baltic Sea. It's a different neighborhood, different situation. But the Baltic states have been threatened by Russia for centuries. They've been independent a lot longer than Ukraine for a lot during that period. But yes, they know that they could basically, they're so small that they could be overrun by what forces the Russians do have available. You know, being nervous about the Russians is a popular national pastime in the Baltic states. And again, it's not fantasy. There is a lot of reality. But they did manage to join NATO, and there was much rejoicing in the Baltic states and in Poland when they finally did, and that was 10 years ago.
Now, what about the other states like Belarus? Obviously, there's been the, you know, the problems in Georgia before, but, you know, Russia is surrounded by former Soviet Union territory.
That is a good point, Dan, because Russia is and has been trying to reabsorb, rebuild the Russian Empire. The Russian Empire was built over, you know, four centuries by mostly the Tsars. The Bolshevik Revolution after World War I temporarily saw it fly apart, and the Bolsheviks were able to put it back together again. That took them, you know, for about 7 or 8 years to complete. Which basically presages what happened in 1991. All these components of the Russian Empire did not want to be part of the Russian Empire, and they still don't. But the Russians are using their economic weapon, and basically the fear of Islamic terrorism, especially in the Central Asian states, the Stans, as they're called, because these countries are majority Muslim and run by basically Soviet-era politicians, as is Belarus. And they are still basically, without being communist, they are basically communist police states. Russians have a problem to the east, however, in that China is competing with them economically. Again, China is way outmatching the Russians militarily in terms of the armed forces, you know, in the area. And China now has a much larger, you know, spending four times as much, you know, three times as much on defense. But the big advantage China has is its much larger GDP. and the investments are pouring into the stands. And basically, these Central Asian states don't really care if the goodies come from Russia or China. They'll do business. They understand that they are caught between two superpowers, Russia and China. And these days, China is the big one. You know, the stands, Central Asian states, the five Central Asian states, used to belong to the Soviet Union. They're glad to be out of it. But if staying independent means playing off China against Russia, they're all good with that. The Russians know this, but the Russians also know that they're outmatched in the East. So the Russians are playing very much a defensive game. And a lot of Russians will tell you that they disagree with this whole strategy. Say, why are we still fighting the Cold War? It's over. We lost. We should have never started in the first place. And unfortunately, nationalist politicians find that you can get enough people yelling and screaming about, yeah, Russia, 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 to get enough votes to get elected in Russia. So that's the way to go. You know, common sense just doesn't get enough votes.
Yeah.
So the Russians are losing in the East, and they feel threatened in the West. And the center is holding, but that's about it.
Austin, what is the motivation for the politicians in Moscow to try to rebuild the Soviet Union?
Well, let me do a little selling of Quick and Dirty Guide to War and some old older editions of Quick and Dirty Guide to War when I, as I answer that, Dan. I want to say it was the post-Cold War edition that came out in 1992. The section on Russia has a discussion of what I dubbed the Rubik at the time, after Rubik's Cube, Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan. And this is something that Jim and I had discussed, and actually I know that I subsequently learned from some analysts working with the Office of Net Assessments in the Pentagon, that they had done a game on this very subject. That is the reassimilation of the most essential components of the Russian Empire, whether it was Tsarist or USSR. Now, the reason that Jim and I had this Rubik is that you take Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan, and this has got an economic component to it as well as a demographic component, Dan, is that you put those together, now you've got the basis for a superpower. Because you got, and I'm being very rough here, but Ukraine, people and food, Belarus, more ethnic Russians, people, also position. Kazakhstan with all its resources and spaces and position, and then Russia with, well, it's desperately needed people, and it needs people even more now. I mean, Jim writes a great deal about the demographic decline of Russia and the loss in the, and especially among men, the lowering of the average lifespan. Now, all the resources, too, that they've got locked up in Siberia take capital and people and time to develop. So if you got those four big pieces back together, you got the basis for a superpower. So right there, and there's an essay, I don't want to say I wrote it in 94, 95, somewhere like this, for one newspaper in Texas. And then you see it in showing up in the 96 edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War again. At some point, a Russian nationalist politician of some sort, didn't call him Vladimir Putin, but somebody's going to say, hey, wait a minute, we get these pieces together, we're big again. And that's, again, this is not a secret. It's just looking at these big pieces and knowing something about, hey, the history of the creation of the Russian Empire and what these elements bring to a larger imperial state. Now, let's go to Jim's point about Vladimir Putin and playing the nationalist card, whether he is actually trying to rebuild this superpower. Rubik, you know, again, the Rubik's Cube. Okay, he's got to take all these pieces and get it right. That's really tough to do. but he certainly does excite and gain political points from the passions that he incites among Russian nationalists. They're still angry. There's, you know, Jim talked about the future-oriented Russians that want to get on with life and make some money and join the global economy. That's a lot of people. There's also a lot of people that are still angry about losing the Cold War. And I think Putin plays on this. He probably is. I mean, here I am giving a psychological read on him, but my God, Dan, he was a big-time KGB agent. You know, he drank the Kool-Aid, and now he's moved from, you know, communist internationalist to Russian ultranationalist. We've seen that happen. Milosevic, and I'm not saying he's Slobodan Milosevic, but Slobodan Milosevic made that move in Belgrade. Started that in 1989, 1990, and look what, of course, happened with the Yugoslav disintegration. Please don't take that as an analog. It's not. Russia didn't go. The USSR did not have the same kind of terrible convulsion as Yugoslavia. But Milosevic made that transition. Putin's made that transition. And the, if you want to equate this RUBK, Rubik, to a greater Russia, or what Russia should consist of, yeah, there are people that believe that. And there are people, Dan, that are willing to fight for it. And Putin has tapped that element, that component of the Russian populace. It does play with myth. It plays with historical historical grievances, as well as a concept of what ought to be. And if we just take advantage of this perceived weakness in the West, by the way, and there is a perceived weakness in the West, maybe this is our moment to make those moves. I don't know. But everything that I've just said, it's you ask about motivation. Here are some of them. The moment, the dream, the moment is the West is weak. The dream is the rebuilt with the strong components of what was the Russian Empire. And there's also the individual power component, which is, hey, I want to stay in power and I want to be strong. And as Jim will say, I want my crony billionaires to be happy, too. So,
Jim, what should the West do to react to what Russia is doing? And have they been reacting well to it? And I say the West because I want to throw NATO and, you know, United States and everybody else together, because it seems to me like they really need to act together on this.
Well, the West has a problem in that all those countries in the West are democracies, and they have to pay attention to, you know, popular attitudes towards what might happen when they do whatever they do. If they do anything that might affect the economies of the Western European states, it won't fly politically, because it will mean lost jobs. And that's, you know, after 2008, the other disaster in 2008, besides Georgia. That's a very sensitive subject. Basically, politics is short-term. Geopolitics is long-term. And what's going on in Ukraine is a long-term, you know, political, geopolitical situation. Long-term, the Russians are in big trouble. But short-term, they can threaten and get away with it because, like I said, the Western Europeans in particular are very reluctant to do anything that would hurt their economies, even in short-term, because that means they'll be unelected. They're not going to win the next elections. And if there's anything a politician dislikes a lot, it's not getting reelected. And this is a reality even in the United States. Basically doing something about Ukraine that will work is risky. Risky economically, not necessarily militarily. The Russians understand that they have greater will. Or they believe they have greater will. That may suddenly change. Who knows? You know, the Europeans might surprise us, because a lot of Europeans are bringing up, you know, Hitler and how the Europeans, the same attitudes among European leaders, you know, short term, you know, the willingness to compromise and to back off and what have you. This rings louder in Europe than it does in the United States, because we were just a distant, bystander, in before World War II, whereas the Europeans were right in the middle of it. And a lot of old timers are out there. Some of them are still, lucid enough to write, op-ed pieces saying, let's not do it again, people. The Putin isn't necessarily the new Hitler, but he's close enough. And there's the old saying, the only thing for tyranny needs to triumph is for good men to do nothing. That's supposed to be, a historical quip that Western leaders are supposed to keep in mind. But, a lot of them are suffering amnesia right now, and I think that's going to persist for a while.
Austin, you want to wrap this all up for us with your thoughts on that?
Man, it's difficult to wrap up. Jim and I, as usual, have gone all over the place, but that's one of the things that you get on Strategy Talk. I look at it. I hope our audience thinks of it as an upside, because as Dunnigan's writing about Russian history and Soviet Union is just absolutely extensive. Another little sales job on this. If you don't think so, go check out Empires of the Middle Ages, that great war game. Here's the point I'd make. You do see, Jim was talking about assimilating and creating the czarist Russian Empire over four centuries. These long-term historical trends are expressed in people that are alive today and living today, because they see the rewards, they've seen the suffering, they've seen the effort that went into it. And I mean, in the Russian view on this, it's both the rewards of having the empire, and also is the fear or paranoia of being attacked from the outside, whether it's by nomads from Central Asia or the Franks and Teutons from Western Europe, or Muslims from the South. And it's, Jim spoke about the appeal of the strong leader. When you sit on the steps and where the heart of Russia is located, this also applies to Ukraine, you're open to attack by nomads. You're open to exploratory raids by armies from the South and invasion from the West. So their line of defense is, we're stronger than you, we have more will, and hey, every once in a while we're going to give you an example of our will. I'm not saying that Crimea is necessarily that, but maybe it is. And that's another way to think about it next time we come back to this subject.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and we'll be talking to you later, guys.
Take care, guys. Bye.
Bye-bye.